Hello and welcome to the Guardian Film Show. This week we're covering the movies in real time, running from the masterpieces to the disasters. Over the next 20 minutes, you shall see us grow up and grow old, break up and make up. What's the point? Who can say? We're all just winging it. Coming up on this week's show, Keira Knightley and Mark Ruffalo make sweet, sweet music in the noodly New York-y folky ballad, Begin Again, and bring on the amazing talking robots that can turn into hot waxed muscle cars. It's Transformers, Age of Extinction. Those classics are yet to come, but we begin with Boyhood, an astonishing coming of age story, 12 years in the making, and chasing an everyday Texas kid through infancy and adolescence, all the way up to the cusp of adulthood. And at the end of that journey, I sat down with the film's actor Ella Coltrane and writer-director Richard Linklater.
Obviously, there's no way to grasp how long 12 years is, you know, when you haven't been alive half, you're barely been alive half that long. So, you know, as far as, you know, really grasping the kind of, you know, the true nature and, you know, kind of scope of the project, that was a very gradual, you know, thing to kind of realize what I was really doing. But I understood, and Rick was always very upfront. You know, he has a great way of talking to especially children. You know, he treated us like people, which is, you know, kind of can be rare.
Rick, Boyhood is the result of effectively a 12-year shoot chasing the child into manhood. How on earth do you prepare and plan a 12-year production?
You don't. You really, you know, you just one little step at a time. You know, you've committed to. But there's always a life metaphor. How do we plan for our own futures? You do your best, but you have to live in the present. So it was the same thing with the production. You know you're collaborating with an unknown future random element, but all you can do is kind of march toward it and adjust as the reality shifts. And I knew the film would go the way Eller, you know, how he developed it. The film would kind of mesh with who he was at some point as far as that characterization. And you know, I was confident in my ability to kind of go with it.
We have a new student joining us today.
Hey, dude. Welcome to the suck. So
Mom. Haven't you been drinking?
A little bit.
Oh.
Joining me now is Peter Bradshaw and Andrew Pulver. Peter, I'm struggling to keep the hyperbole in check, but I love this film so much.
Yeah, me too. It's one of the few times in a critic's life when the word love really means something. I really did fall in love with this film. I fell in love with him. I fell in love with Ethan Hawke and Patricia Arquette playing his estranged parents. Mm. I loved Lorelei Linklater playing his elder sister, Samantha. I just adored it. It really means something to me. It means something to me now. I'm thinking about it now. I find myself thinking about it days after seeing it.
I can't believe it's not still going on somewhere.
No, I still can't either. I mean, there was such an exquisite humility in the film, in the way Linklater leaves him alone as an adult at the end of the movie. I wonder if he will return to it. I wonder if they will return to it like Michael Apted with 7-Up. He will return to it and make adulthood or middle age or something like that. I can see him doing it. I can see it being a fascinating thing. And part of me desperately wants Mason to come back into my life. But also, I think it might be a mistake. I don't know. But what a wonderful film. It really was. I just sat there thinking, my goodness, this is a masterpiece of kind of serendipity as well, because he must have set out not knowing how it would turn out. Of course, people could die. Ella Coltrane himself could decide to quit show business.
Of course.
So the whole thing might have gone down the pan.
Which makes it such a kind of weirdly optimistic movie.
Yes,
it's about growth and moving on
exactly.
And living in flux.
It kind of imitates the kind of lineaments of documentary in real life, and yet, of course, it is a fiction. What an achievement for Linklater. My goodness, it's one of those few times when you feel like you have an evangelical duty to put on the sandwich board and march up and down the streets saying, go and see this film. I really do think that. It's a wonderful, wonderful film.
Andrew, you're going to rain on our parade.
Absolutely not. I mean, for me, Linklater's achieved the Holy Grail in some ways. I mean, there's a certain school of filmmakers who have always been chasing, trying to represent real life on screen, and you know they do it in various ways. You know, all the various new wave filmmakers have their own sort of ways of sort of getting away from the artifice of narrative and studio bound
and the prism of time.
The prism of time, exactly. And I think Linklater solved it. You know, he has stuck with this kid for 12 years, and as you say, I mean, you can definitely tell watching the film. There are certain points when the actor, you know, clearly wasn't that happy. You know, when he reaches early teens, you know, child actors often lose it when they get in their early teens. Mm. They lose the unself-consciousness. They become very awkward, and you can tell that he's not happy acting. But then he sort of comes back to it, and when he's a bit older,
but even that enjoys works it because he's an awkward adolescent.
Absolutely, it sort of chimes perfectly with the sort of rest of the film. And there's, you know, the one comparable film event is the Harry Potter movies, where when all the casts were cast when they were 10 or 11, and they were sort of cast for seven films, and was it eight films in the same sort of time span, and you knew you were going to watch them getting older. And there's actually an extended scene in Boyhood where they all go and see a Harry Potter film and
they get the Harry Potter books. And it's sort of weirdly moving because this is a contemporary moment. There's actual kids queuing up in their Harry Potter costumes to buy the book. Yeah. That just suddenly feels like this kind of weird little nugget of history that is so kind of so heartbreaking.
Yeah, I mean, I sometimes feel that the achievement of the Harry Potter movies is perhaps not discussed as often as it should be in these terms, this extraordinary achievement that they had in getting Daniel Radcliffe et al. To stick with it for such a long period of time. Although I'm quite sure that they didn't really see it that way. They thought that they had to, as faithfully as possible, represent the franchise on screen, and this was the only way to do it. I don't think they had the same aesthetic outlook that Linklater had with one single film, because obviously the difference is, of course, these are different films, and Radcliffe et al. Had the chance to see himself and readjust his behaviour in the light of what he can see and the actual event of his growing colossal celebrity, whereas Ella Coltrane had nothing of the sort. Mm. He was just turning up every few years, doing the scenes, and as I understand it, contributing to a couple of other movies as well, a couple of other conventional movies, but with no real idea as to how this was actually going to turn out as one single unitary film. Another fascinating thing is that he is interested in still photography, and there is a still photography aesthetic, of course, within the movie. It shows a series of photographs, as a series of photographs will show in a family photo album, that will disclose the sudden leaps and jumps of development, but also contains within it that sphinx-like mystery. Mm. What is my child thinking? You don't know, because, of course, they are growing into adulthood. They are assuming the prerogatives of adulthood, which is their privacy and their separateness, and their right not to tell you what they're thinking, and not to be cuddled. And that's what makes it so unendurably heartbreaking, this film.
And also, you know, sorry, for a parent, it's almost like a horror movie. You know, I'm just sort of thinking about my own small children, thinking, God, you know, I've got all this to come.
Mm. Yeah. And that's what's so heartbreaking about his mother at the very end saying, you know, I've just got these few events to look forward to, and that's it. Yeah. And we have seen...
She's talking to us.
She's talking to us. Yeah, she's shown us these two events, these three, four, five events have been telescoped in front of our very eyes in a long film that seems terrifyingly short. And then there's nothing else. And then he kind of lopes off in his kind of cool way to college, leaving behind him this nuclear winter of emotional devastation and emptiness trauma.
What do you want to be, Mason? What do you want to do?
That's Richard Linklater's Boyhood, my runaway favourite film from the first half of 2014. We'd rather not leave it, but time marches on. So clear the decks and reset the clock. Begin Again stars Mark Ruffalo and Keira Knightley as a washed-up record producer and his singer-songwriting muse. And here they are to tell The Guardian's Henry Barnes all about it.
I'm in.
What?
I want to make records with you. I want to produce you. I want to sign you. We're meant to work together.
Sorry, didn't you see what just happened up there?
Yeah, what? Are you feeling sorry for yourself?
No, I like my music. I mean, who cares if they don't get it, right?
You need to work on your performance a little bit.
Well, I'm not a performer. I just write songs from time to time.
Are other songs as good as that one?
Wait, are you really an A&R man? You just look more like a homeless man.
I've been out celebrating all week, and I just signed a band. We got carried away. That's some song you got there. I promise you it could be a big hit.
There's something amazing about the artist's spirit, where they will do something where it doesn't matter if it makes money, and they're doing it because they love it, and I think that's what she's talking about. And that's the case with most people that I've worked with who work in the creative arts, whether they do it commercially or whether they don't. You know, I think it's an obsession that kind of drives everybody.
So just come to my label and let me play your demo to my partner. If it doesn't work out, I will personally pay to change your ticket. What's one more day in New York, for crying out loud? You're just probably gonna go home and mope around anyway.
All right, look, I'm gonna go home and think about it, and I'll call you either way tomorrow, okay?
Good answer.
Yeah. It was very nice to meet you.
Pleasure. Pleasure's mine. Hey, you got my number, right?
Yeah.
That probably the people that we love the most are those people who express themselves in an uncompromising fashion to some degree. You know, the trend sometimes as an artist is to try and copy somebody else's thing or try to guess at what's going to be popular, but. No one ever likes an artist because they're like somebody else. You know, they like them because that artist is completely original unto themselves. And so I think that's a bad trap to fall into.
Andrew, did this stir happy memories of your own time as a songbird in New York?
Afraid not. I think what really struck me about this film was every now and then the film industry gets a bit preoccupied about its own sort of lameness and the fact that it's mostly middle-aged people who are involved in sort of, you know, making these things. And they then go over to the music industry to try and buy a bit of cool and try and make a film about the music, you know, about musicians or pop stars. And it almost never works. I can't think of any, you know, kind of relatively dramatic film about aspiring pop stars that actually is plausible in any way, and I'm afraid this didn't do it for me again. I mean, the director has done something not dissimilar before. He made John Carney, who made Once,
which I really liked,
which was really good, and you know, it's turned into a musical, stage musical as well, and it sort of seemed to be plausible and authentic, whereas this, I'm afraid, just didn't. I think for me the biggest problem was that, you know, Keira Knightley is clearly having what I'll call a Helena Bonham Carter moment, where she's absolutely nailed these costume dramas. She's brilliant in them. You know, obviously a lot of people give her stick, but I think she's a great performer in those films. And now she's sort of a bit stuck and thinking, got to try and contemporise, update the image somehow. And this is one of the things she's doing to try and do that. And, you know, anybody less convincing to me as a sort of indie, folky, ballady type person picking up a guitar in a club, it just didn't work. I mean, I heard
she's given a run for her money by James Corden.
Yeah, he's slightly less implausible as being a completely useless busker, I have to say. But I think people, to me, she's sort of modelling it. I mean, I don't know if she is or not, but it seems to me modelled on people like Catherine Williams and those sort of people. You can sort of tell they're bringing themselves into their work and all that sort of thing. But an actor doing that, you can just tell they're actors, really. They're not really bringing the grit to the performance.
Mm. Andrew's mentioning Once, and it struck me this is like the kind of remix, remastered, slightly overproduced version of Once. Yeah. There's no kind of grit or jeopardy there,
absolutely.
Is there?
I mean, if ever the metaphor difficult second album was justified, it's here. I mean, clearly Carney has, you know, his career has gone through this fantastic uptick after everybody loved Once, especially in the US. And he wants to bring back some of that busk aesthetics, that lo-fi, non-sellout aesthetic to this film. But of course he is selling out because of course he's making a much bigger budget, glam, fancy, top name movie. And so he has to contrive this weird and utterly implausible idea that they will make the album outside in New York. Why? You know, it's not even just her alone with a guitar. Mm. They somehow just get loads and loads of session
sort of industrial
musicians. Yeah, which isn't the point at all, surely. And you don't have to be, surely, an expert to know that you could achieve the same result in audio terms simply by going to somebody's apartment and faking in the ambient noises digitally. Frankly, you don't need to go outside and outdoors. It would just sound the same if you just faked it indoors. And that's the obvious point of objection. Maybe you wouldn't.
But they're keeping it real.
Yeah, you see, they're keeping it real, but they're not. Everything is unreal about them keeping it real. especially this idea that he would have to hire all these session musicians who have to gallop around after her with a huge amount of recording equipment. It just doesn't make sense. And the idea that Mark Ruffalo loses his job, but sort of doesn't. Mm. You know, it doesn't seem to cost him anything because he's back in the office hanging out the next scene. And even his drinking, the age-old Hollywood law that if you see a character waking up and then getting stuck into a half a bottle of scotch, they're going to lose interest in drinking halfway through the film, or it's going to be not a real problem in the sense that a real problem in the real world would be. Mm. And so
it's just step one on their redemptive journey.
Yes, he's an adorable drinker, and yet he doesn't seem to be an alcoholic. He never has to go to meetings, and it doesn't seem to harm his relationship or his career, this new second act of his career, in any real way.
But also, you know, one of the big problems of a film like this is that they're sort of singing and doing things musically that they are constantly saying are absolutely fantastic and
amazing. That was
amazing.
A problem I had with it. Yeah. I was thinking, is this supposed to be the good song or the bad song?
You can't tell. And you know, individual songs, you know, take on their meaning by going out in the culture or sort of being part of the ether, being on the radio and people hearing it, particular stage of their life and all the sort of stuff. So to be sort of handed new stuff sung by somebody who's, Keira Knightley did the singing, you know, perfectly well, but, you know, she's not going to be winning Grammys soon, I would have thought. And to be but constantly sort of everybody in the film yelling about
this is brilliant. Yeah,
this is fantastic.
All the time. And this is the key thing, that there's
what
this
you
one
call unearned, you know, Peter's always using that phrase in his reviews, and it's totally unearned.
Yeah. There's this one song that is the kind of the key text for the film. And there's two different versions of it.
Yeah.
There's the great version and the bad version. I genuinely couldn't tell the difference.
It's an absolute mystery to me.
Let's record an album. And the city is our studio.
You mean record outside? Tell me
if you wanna go. Every song we do in a different location.
An outdoor album.
I wish I could have thought of that.
All over New York City.
Yeah, it'll be beautiful.
Knightley and Ruffalo weave a musical tapestry in Begin Again, which, like Boyhood, is playing in selected cinemas up and down the country. In the meantime, all the other cinemas are showing this. Transformers: Age of Extinction contains Autobots and Decepticons, a rugged inventor and a teenage daughter in denim cutoffs. There are car chases and robot battles and a dark and dastardly plot to take over the world. And here endeth the crash course primer for Age of Extinction.
This is not war. It's human extinction.
Oh my God! Bumblebee!
How many more of my kind must be sacrificed?
You gotta have faith, Prime. Maybe not in who we are,
in who we can be.
Peter, bearing in mind that more people are going to go and see Transformers than Boyhood, this does at least give them some bang for their buck.
Yes, it does. It does do that. It does provide, in its barking mad way, a kind of value for money. And a heretical part of me sort of wonders, why is it that the Transformers movies are so critically derided, much more than superheroes movies, to be honest, some of the time? And it's not quite as bad as everybody says, to be honest. Stanley Tucci, who belatedly emerges as a rather elegant, droll comic hero of the whole thing, is this sub-Steve Jobs, very absurd and conceited corporate innovator, I thought was actually quite good in a way. The Transformers franchise has now been going on, feels like it's been going on forever. The first one was in 2007, so it's 7 years, four movies. It's been going long enough to have its own curse of Transformers for quite a lot of people who are involved in it. Megan Fox, sacked for comparing Mr. Bay to Hitler, rather tactless of her. Poor old Shia LaBeouf, of course, he's gone off way upriver, the troubles of his own, and the Transformers celebrity contributed to that. British underwear model Rosie Huntington-Whiteley, of course, had her moment of glory in the last oddly named film, Transformers Dark of the Moon. Mm. Now she hasn't been brought back, sad for her. And now we've got this new one. I think it's kind of, it's almost physically oppressive, the Transformer film. You almost feel physically crushed, as if you were sort of 10,000 leagues under the sea, crushed by it, and you feel deafened by it. It's quite punishing to go through. It is 2¾ hours long. I suspect because there is simply no executive or company accountant who can tell Michael Bay to cut something out. There is simply nobody who has got the cojones to stand up to the great man. It is pretty silly and pretty awful some of the time, and yet it kind of hangs together in a bizarre way, and it has a kind of ambition of its own, and there are moments of humour and a kind of brio to it. So I've seen worse, to be honest with you. I think the last two Transformers movies haven't been quite as intolerable as the first two. Again, not a poster quote, I know. Not a poster quote. But, however absurd the Transformers films are, I've sort of seen worse.
I've seen worse as well. I mean, the first half, I was first hour, maybe, I was thinking this is like, you know, the real totems of kind of adolescent... kind of joy, isn't it? It's sports cars, it's pretty girls. And then you think, but you're not actually doing anything with it. So it's like having a sports car and just driving it up and down the freeway. There's no journey there.
No, I mean, I have to confess, I've never actually seen any Transformers film before. So I'm sort of new to it.
And missing so much.
Yeah, well,
and I had your weekend sorted.
That's your weekend sorted.
But I have to say, the thing that really surprised me about this was the first hour wasn't too bad, and I realised why in retrospect. Is because the thing that I found really bafflingly useless about this film are the robots and the monsters. Mm. You know,
the robots are
so the first hour is like Mark Wahlberg and his daughter and
picket
the surfer
fence,
guy,
American flags,
just sort of yelling at each other and having kind of being a bit rowdy. And it's, although it's not what you call great scripting, it's it's okay. It's a bit like Twisty, that sort of, hey, there's a whole group dynamic thing going on and everybody's kind of arguing with each other, and then the robots or the Autobots sort of turn up, and suddenly the IQ of the film just plunges to the floor. They're completely useless. They don't even look like robots. They don't behave like they're made of metal. They're clearly blokes in motion capture suits, obviously on a huge scale, and almost in a way like those 50s movies with people in rubber suits, everybody used to laugh at for being so cheap. I mean, this is unbelievably expensive, but they still have the same sort of effect. And also, they just sort of talk to each other. Like, it struck me as essentially this is a rehearsal for a Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles movie, because there's basically four of these kind of lame robots who are sort of a team, and they're sort of good guys, and they're kind of fighting the other guys, and they spend all the time arguing with each other in this really juvenile way, saying,
but if
I'm going to beat your ass.
You'd know they each have their own individual personalities.
Well,
you have your favourite.
Maybe
you say,
they do.
He's got a zinger in there.
Well, maybe they do, but it's, as I said, it's so much more idiotic than the fairly idiotic opening.
I'm not leaving my dad.
Need a new army.
That's gotta hurt. Michael Bay's Age of Extinction bringing this week's show to its own miniature ice age. My thanks to Peter Bradshaw and Andrew Pulver. We're back, thawed out, and hopefully regenerated to continue the journey same time next week.